Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are legendary sports and NFL expert Greg Cosell, senior producer at NFL Films, and Mississippi gubernatorial candidate Brandon Presley. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper and Hold On Bags, in the show notes. We really thank you for supporting our sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, I had my expectations for the State of the Union were somewhere between minimal and a little modest. The entire exercise really seems kind of passe, and President Biden is not an electrifying or inspiring speaker. I was wrong. It was an electrifying evening, a 10 for Biden. He was energetic, focused, credibly said State of the Union is strong, lowest unemployment more than 50 years, inflation ebbing, record number of Americans with health insurance. I mean, with last year's legislation, there's going to be $1 trillion in investments ahead, a lot for blue-collar jobs. And he focused on all the right things ahead, lower health care costs, more support for children and the like, and said billionaires shouldn't be paying a lower tax rate than school teachers. James, you can run on that anywhere in America. I mean, I don't know any place where that would be anything but a winner. And he didn't look 80. But his success also had a critical co-pilot, the rowdy, rude, boorish Republican caucus, yelling liar, bullshit, and other such niceties. It made the president look so good. You could see the angst on Speaker McCarthy's face on the rostrum. And then in the greatest trap since Michael Corleone set up Senator Gary and the Godfather, he said some Republicans want to cut Social Security or even sunset it, which, of course, some did, looking at you, Rick Scott. But that enraged the crazies. They got up and yelled and screamed. And he said, okay, you know, then we'll take Social Security and Medicare off the table. And they all cheered. So it's off the table for budget negotiations. And boy, does that put him in a bind. What a triumph.
Yeah, but I guess its impact will be in infamous words of Warden Norton in the Shawshank Redemption, a fart in the wind. You know, it should, if anybody paid attention to it. It would consolidate what's happened in America in the last 2 years and what's happened in the Republican Party. And I hope I'm wrong, but again, I think we're looking at a political fart in the wind.
Oh, I think not. I think not so much because of Biden, because of the Republicans. I think they showed their colors. And yeah, you kind of knew it ahead of time, but it was so obnoxious last night. And I think that was, I think people's, I don't
I
know.
I hope you're right. I think their rudeness and immaturity. Look, if you ask me, I think that the balloon was an IQ test. Okay? And when you're trying to shoot a balloon down that's 11 and a third miles in the air, you're going to be rude and stupid, just like they were last night. But we should have known from the balloon that nothing was good was going to happen.
Well, I would, you know, I'm no Biden sycophant, as you know, but I thought he handled the balloon almost perfectly. He had the wisdom to wait and the measure. You know, he got the best option, ordered it shot down on F-22 over the Atlantic Ocean, recovered important intelligence. It's Beijing and Xi Jinping who suffered a big embarrassment here, not as Mike Gallagher and Marco Rubio charged America.
Yeah. I agree. I'm just saying that the balloon just demonstrated how many stupid people we have in this country. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. But of course, I don't have any problem with the way you handled it. And I mean, the idea that you're going to take a AR-15 and shoot something 11 miles in the sky is absurd. And I don't think these people took seventh grade physics, because they would know whatever go up has to come down. The bullet's coming down. You don't know where. Understand? But it was just, it was so profoundly stupid on their part, and it was so universal on their part that you couldn't believe it. And I hope I'm wrong, but it just demonstrates how hopelessly stupid 40% of this country is.
Well, you know, I agree with that. James, let me ask you a question, you know, and try to give me a serious answer. Do you think there's any chance that Marjorie Taylor Greene is a Democratic mole?
You know, in a normally you would sort of think that no one could be that idiotic, that stupid, that counterproductive, that rude. But then you go back and you look at the video of her chasing David Hogg, you know, one of the kids from Parkland, and you say, she is that stupid. She is that rude. She is that idiotic. She is that unclassic, common. She's not even common. She's worse than that. And I actually think that's who she is.
Yeah. No,
I'd like to think that the Democrats were smart enough to make her a mole, but I don't think we had to.
And she's I'll tell you something.
I like that competition, but her and Lauren Boebert.
Oh, wow.
And understand, every time they do that, that they get a text from their tech section fundraising and said, we just racked up $1.7 million in contributions.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, only a cut above. The DNC should have bought time for Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I only watched part of it. But her rebuttal last night, she raised such critical issues facing the country as to whether Democrats can define a woman. It was as low grade a substantive speech as could possibly be imagined. These are never easy, the rebuttals to the State of the Union, and she managed to lower the bar even further.
Somebody told me she was worse than Jindal was, which is pretty hard.
Well, that's a really good point, James, because that is the test. I think she got the Bobby Jindal Award. I think it'd be a close competition.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Boebert against Green.
You know, I'm 78. I can't watch. I can watch excerpts, and she's a, I know her a little bit. She's a nice lady. No one ever confused her with, you know, having Bill Clinton's brain.
Oh, my God. Well, I know another reason you didn't watch it, James, because you're tired. Why are you tired? You have a new grandson. You want to tell us just a little bit about Liam before we move on? A little bit of an upbeat note?
Yeah. On 2/3/23 at 8:06 p.m., coming in this earth, land 8 pounds and 6 ounces. At Ashner Hospital on O'Neill Lane in Baton Rouge, young Mr. Liam Campbell Carville Joel came into this world. And I'm generally like traditional, but Liam, my brother, deceased brother's name is William. And Sam, my son-in-law's favorite uncle is named William, and Liam is William for Irish. So I love
Irish
this
William,
name.
Right. Right.
And he's we had a difficult delivery, and we had a few little moments of concern there, but everything is A-okay. And I've already gone and got his Mardi Gras little uniform here, you know, because he's coming down to see his first Mardi Gras parade. And this was the 24th of 2 weeks.
James, at 8 pounds, 6 ounces, he's a potential future Tiger linebacker.
He might be at that. Be coming in at that, yeah. And of course, I'm actually going to go to Baton Rouge and watch the Super Bowl with him, because when you're 78, you don't know how many Super Bowls you're going to get to watch with your grandson. So
wow.
I'm sure he's pretty unaware. But at any rate, I got to go get my fix of Liam.
Terrific. Congratulations. And,
you know,
congratulations to you and to Maddie and to Mary. And, you know, we're just so happy.
He's already
for you.
Got 50 books in his library.
I'll tell you, there's nothing better than grandfatherhood. My friend Michael Gardner said one time, it's like renting a high-end Mercedes. It's a magnificent drive, and you get to return it at night. So you're gonna have many years of enjoyment of this.
There you go.
Our guest is the smartest NFL analyst, Greg Cosell of NFL Films. Greg, your longtime colleague and my dear friend Steve Sable loved to tell a story, a great narrative. This Super Bowl is the Steve Sable Invitational. Best offense in football against the best defense. Two of a handful of the three or four best quarterbacks. First time two black signal callers starting a Super Bowl.
Who's Mrs. Kelce cheering for? Son Jason, the Eagles All-Pro center, or son Travis, the Chiefs All-Pro tight end, and Andy Reid coaching against his old team? It doesn't get any better than that.
Well, the one thing that can't happen because it's the Super Bowl, Al, is it can't be a tie. Maybe it was a regular season game, he'd be pulling for a tie. But obviously that can't happen in the Super Bowl.
What are you looking for?
Oh, there's so many. This game, you know I have to pick a score at the end of this or pick a winner. And I've been asked that all week already, and it's only Wednesday. And I'm really struggling with this, guys, because there's so many variables in this game, tactical variables, that I I can get a handle on tactically, but I just don't know how it's going to play out. You know, one of the things about the Chiefs, because, you know, obviously Mahomes is magical. They've become a team that plays with multiple tight ends, 2-3 tight ends on 40-45% of their offensive snaps. And I bet a lot of people aren't aware of that because they think of, you know, Mahomes, high-powered offense, throw the ball around. But they play with tight ends because their tight ends are really receivers more than true tight ends. So I'm really anxious to see how the Eagles match up to that, because that's you have to have a plan for that because of where Kelce lines up. You know, he doesn't line up like a traditional tight end where he's attached to the offensive tackle.
Right. Well, you mentioned Patrick Mahomes, the great Patrick Mahomes. You know, we haven't seen this much attention to an ankle since Marilyn Monroe. I mean, he played with great grit and courage against the Bengals, but he wasn't 100%. Do you have any sense of how close he'll be on Sunday? Because, and they have to protect him. That Eagles linebacker, Haason Reddick, knocked out two 49er quarterbacks.
Yeah. He'll be better. He won't be 100%. You know, high ankle sprains, obviously he's getting the best treatment possible. You know, for normal people, I remember back in the Stone Age when I had high ankle sprains, you know, guys playing basketball in college, you know, they took 6-8 weeks. Now he's getting, great, great treatment. So he'll be better. And I think he'll be able to move around if need be. But the point you brought up is a great one, because I think one of the things I think they'll do early in the game is get the ball out of his hands quick, whether it's, you know, quick game throws, RPOs. They'll try to develop a rhythm in their pass game so that the ball can come out quick. Now, obviously, all that changes when it becomes 3rd and 9, and there's always 3rd and longs in every game. But I think they'll try to establish an early rhythm with their pass game. And I think they're going to try to run the ball a little bit as well. You know, I think they're going to try to attack that Eagles 5-man defensive front with the run game, particularly the outside zone run game.
You know, the Eagles quarterback, Jalen Hurts, his story is amazing, as amazing as Mahomes. Only a second-round draft choice. He has transformed that team in 2 years. I think this is right, Greg. He was a champion weightlifter. I'm sure he's the strongest quarterback in the NFL. But this is the biggest stage for this young kid. What are you expecting?
Yeah, well, you know, people forget, which is why the story is even more remarkable, Al, that he was actually benched at Alabama because he couldn't throw very well. Right. And people probably forget that. But really, this is Hurts' offense. It runs through him because of the factor in the run game. It's really hard to explain because people would probably need to see it, you know, which I do when I do my matchup show. But everything really runs through him because of the run game factor. So it's really, really hard to defend. They line up with him in the shotgun on almost every snap. And there's literally 4 or 5 plays that can happen on any play just because he's in the gun. Now, they may just call one play. It could be, hey, we're going to hand it off, and that's the play call. But the thing is, the defense doesn't know that. And there's so many plays that could emanate just from him being in the gun. And it makes it so difficult to defend because of the running factor.
James.
So, Greg, like a sports fan, I read a lot of commentary, and I read something that struck me, and it's something I read I wanted to ask you about. What struck me is pretty insightful, that the key early in the game is going to be, can the Philadelphia, the front four, get pressure on Mahomes without the blitz, that Mahomes is particularly good dealing with a blitz.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you, that they're going to have to get – non-blitz, they can't give them that much time.
The Eagles are an interesting defense, James, because they play a lot of 5-man defensive fronts because, you know, Reddick is really an outside edge pass rusher. He's not a true linebacker, and same with Josh Sweat. So they play with a 5-man defensive front a good percentage of the time. And they're not a heavy blitz team because a lot of times they'll rush those five defensive linemen, which some people will say is a blitz, but it's really not when it's five defensive linemen. So, you know, that gets back to what I said a moment ago in how the Chiefs choose to attack that. Will the Chiefs come out and throw early and try to get the ball out of Mahomes' hands quick and to establish some rhythm? Will they try to run the ball? Because obviously you don't want to get into third and long, because where the Eagles have a big time advantage, James, is on the edge. If it's third and long, Reddick and Sweat are a matchup problem for the two tackles for the Chiefs. So that's a big factor in this game.
So if you can bet during the game and it's fourth and one, the Eagles have fourth and one, bet they're going to make it. Between Kelce and Hurts, almost guaranteed fourth and one team.
Yeah, they're going to call a quarterback sneak too, because they do that time and they make it.
Yeah. Every time they're going to call. I was like, Terps played at Oklahoma, and we played LSU. We being LSU, we played them in December 2019. We're going to beat them 80-4 if we wanted to. And I was just sort of colored by his time in Oklahoma and did not realize how good he was. So I apologize to Jalen Hurts. Because, yeah, right, he had to leave Alabama, but it was Tua, you know, just like Joe Burrow had to leave Ohio State.
Well, there were like 40 players picked ahead of him in the draft, too.
Well, you know, funny, I can tell you for a fact, guys, because I know the organization well in Philadelphia, because I'm right outside of Philadelphia at NFL Films, that when the Eagles drafted Hurts, he was drafted with the express purpose of being Carson Wentz's backup. He wasn't drafted for the purpose of being a starting quarterback, because that was at the time when Lamar Jackson was, you know, doing all those Lamar Jackson things with the Ravens offense. And the Eagles felt that they could incorporate some of that with Jalen Hurts as an adjunct to Carson Wentz. So, you know, this obviously turned out really well, but he was not drafted with the intent of being a starting quarterback.
Well, you mentioned, so I'm gonna go off script here just for a second. What's the situation with Lamar Jackson and the Ravens?
It's a great question. You know, the way I'd answer that is this. And again, I'm not there. You know, I always struggle, James, to talk about process of teams, because you have to be there to understand the process. But there's no way that any offensive coordinator wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? We don't want big plays in the passing game. No one says that. They all want big plays in the passing game. So the only thing I would say is you have to ask the question. You know, it's probably like in any field, you know, you're in politics. You always have to ask the question and the next question to try to find the real answers. Why do they not have a lot of big plays in the pass game? Why do receivers not want to play there? I don't know the answer to that. This is not a personal knock, and I don't do anything personal, but this is not a knock on Lamar Jackson. But there's no way any team's offensive coaches wake up and say, we don't want big plays in the passing game. So if you're not getting big plays in the passing game, you have to ask yourself why.
Well, go back to Al. If they figure that out, they're going to win the Super Bowl next year. That's a good football team. I mean, I watched them, you know, they never threw a quarterback. I watched them play the Bengals. I was obviously pulling for the Bengals, but that Baltimore's pretty damn good. But anyway, the game at hand.
And it's not as if Lamar can't throw the football, but it's just, you know, they played a certain way. And then you have to add, again, the same why question. Why do they choose to play this way? Why do they choose to play? Think of it this way, James. You know, you're obviously a very smart, thoughtful guy. There's five eligible receivers on every single play. So why did they choose to play with one player, Patrick Ricard, who's essentially a guard, but he's really an eligible receiver, and they don't use him at all? So they're choosing to play with four eligible receivers when you can play with five. And it's just an interesting dynamic, and I'm curious to see how they move forward at this point.
Yeah. Hey, Greg, talk about these two coaches on Sunday. Andy Reid, I think he's entering that pantheon of the all-time greats, the Lombardi, Shula, yep, Belichick's. While Nick Sirianni, who was actually fired by Andy Reid, I think, 10 years ago, is one tough, really engaging young guy who inherited a 4-11-1 team and turned it around.
Yeah, I think they had a great, great understanding of Jalen Hurts and what he brings to the table. And what he brings to the table as an overall player, the run game element, the pass game element. And it's not just the coaches. Well, there's a couple of other people who I think need to be mentioned, Al, now that you want to talk about specific players and people. I think Howie Roseman's done an unbelievable job assembling this roster. You can
Eagles GM.
You can easily make the point that the Eagles are the most talented football team in the NFL, you know, top to bottom. So they are really good. And the other coach who I think needs to be mentioned, because this is not his first rodeo, is the defensive coordinator for the Chiefs, Steve Spagnuolo. You know, he's been a defensive coordinator that's won Super Bowls. Many might forget that he was the Giants defensive coordinator in 2007 when they beat the Patriots and held them, I believe, to 14 points that in that Super Bowl game. And he will have a plan for dealing with Hurts. Now, we don't know if it'll be a successful plan, but he will have a specific plan. I don't know what it is. He's a lot smarter than I am, so I don't know what it'll be. But he's been around the block. So, you know, you're dealing with some really good coaches here as well.
The other thing is the franchises themselves. We painfully learned in Washington that ownership really matters. But over the last 10 years, these two Chiefs have won like 106 games. The Eagles are one of the three or four best over a long period of time. You got to give a lot of credit to Jeffrey Lurie and the Hunts, don't you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you talk, look, I know a lot of coaches through the years, and the first thing they'll say is it all starts at the top and how it filters down. You know, it's one thing to have a great coach, and you're 100% right. Andy Reid will be a Hall of Fame coach without question. He's at that level of coach. But, you know, it all starts at the top. If you don't get the proper support, and, you know, football is a funny business. You know, owners have been very, very successful in whatever field that they've been in, but it's not the same. You know, sports are not the same as, you know, running a, you know, whatever other business you're in. And it's a whole different animal. And you have to give Lurie, as you said, Jeffrey Lurie, a ton of credit, Hunt, a ton of credit, Clark Hunt. I mean, these, you know, they understand how to let the organization function the right way.
What sleeper or what surprise can you look for or might you look for on Sunday?
Well, I think there's a couple of things the variables in this game when you get to the tactics of it. Number one, who's going to match up to Travis Kelce when the Eagles play man-to-man? And the corollary to that is, will they bracket him or double team him in certain down and distance situations? Because other than obviously Mahomes, the Chiefs offense runs through Travis Kelce. So you have to have a plan. You can't just play your normal defense, you know, when it's third and six. You just can't say, okay, we're just going to line up and play and see what happens. You have to have a plan. So I'm very curious to see what the D coordinator, John Gannon, does for, you know, as far as matching up to Kelce. And then if you look at, you know, the Eagles offense, you know, I think that a real sleeper player for them is their tight end. You could argue, yeah, Kelsey's the best tight end in the game. Dallas Goedert is probably a top three, four tight end in the game. He just doesn't have the numbers. He would have had big numbers if he didn't miss four or five games. But I think he's a really, really important player here for the Eagles. So, you know, the tight ends to me are significant players in how the opposing defense deals with them.
James?
There's 1,000 proposition prop bets. I mean, no one's that better than anybody else. Of course, we're going to ask you to pick, but, you know, the over-under in this game is 51. Where's your gut on that? You think there'll be over 51 or under 51?
Well, I'm first going to say that I don't even know what a prop bet is. I've never bet James on a sporting event in my life, so I'm not one of those people. What that means, but if you're talking about over under 51, yeah. my immediate inclination would be over, but we've seen Super Bowls where we thought they'd be really high scoring games and they were not. So to me, this game, like I started with, this game's really hard for me because there's so many factors and I'm not sure how they're going to play out, but my sense is there'll be points scored in this game. I mean, I don't think this is going to be a 2017 game, but hey, I've been wrong before, right? I mean, I've gotten a few of these wrong, you know, and that's the way it goes.
So people ask me about predicting election outcomes, and the great Peter Hart told me something earlier in my career. You're not here to predict elections, you're here to affect elections.
Right.
And I don't think that Bill Belichick has a better idea than I do on who's going to win the game. And he knows 6,000 times more football. or you know, 6 hours more. Well, but that's the great thing about sports is that there's no guarantee.
No, and you know what? Belichick's obviously smarter than all of us when it comes to football, but he would give you 10, 12 variables that are the main variables in this game, and you're not exactly sure how those will play out. That's why I'm struggling with this game, because I think so many factors, and I don't really know how they're going to play out. And, you know, could the Eagles score 35? They could. Could the Chiefs score 35? Because Mahomes is magical. I mean, Mahomes, I'm not sure I've seen a quarterback with a better feel for spatial awareness and where people are on the field than Mahomes.
Right. Well, you and Bill Belichick don't know who's going to win the game. I said, a guy at the end of the bar in New Orleans, he has definite opinion. Don't know who's going to win the game.
Well, we're not going to let him off, James. We're not going to let him off. I mean, he is now the last year, 1-1 the last 2 years. So this is the tiebreaker, Greg. I know don't like to do it, and we had all the caveats, but Sunday night, what's the scoreboard going to look like?
So if I get this wrong, am I done, Al? Is he going to move on to the guy?
You will never be done. We'll talk about Bill Belichick.
You know, if I'm reducing this to simplest terms, and I don't like to do that because of the kind of work I do, but I think the Eagles are a better team, but then I feel like you have the Mahomes factor. So that's what I'm really struggling with. So, all right, here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to say that the Eagles are going to win this game 31-27.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's the over. And I'll tell you this, Greg, first of all, you got a lot of guts to go out on a limb like that. And we're going to have you back no matter what. Steve Sable, I think missed 7 out of 8. So, you know, that's the business. I can't remember a Super Bowl that I look forward to as much as this one. It just has all the elements.
I'm really excited about it. I'm glad it's outside. I'm glad the weather's going to be beautiful. I just got to Phoenix. You know, I just got to my hotel room. So I'm in Phoenix. The weather's beautiful. It's supposed to be beautiful all weekend. I'm really looking for, you know, maybe I'm old school, but, you know, I really like the outdoor Super Bowls because I still get a little teary-eyed with the flyovers, that, you know, guys. There's something about those flyovers that always get to me.
So my favorite thing at Super Bowl, Greg, is having you on the podcast every year. Honestly,
next year in Vegas, then it's in New Orleans, so we'll have to get together.
So I don't think anybody. I have a Super Bowl record. I think no one else has. I attended Super Bowl I. I was in a Super Bowl Coca-Cola ad, and I was co-chairman of a Super Bowl host committee.
Really?
I think I have a unique Super Bowl.
James, you are wonderful. You really are. I've known you, but James, you are no Greg Cosell.
I don't try to be.
I don't know, Al, you may not be saying that, you know, this game. We'll see how it plays out.
Well, yeah, all right. And, Greg, I'm glad that Steve is now in the Canton Hall of Fame.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
You will be there one day. Thank you. Have a great couple days and a great game, Greg.
All right, guys.
Thank you, man. We love having you on the show. Thank you.
Hey, our next guest, James, is Brandon Presley, a strong and very effective consumer advocate on the Mississippi Public Service Commission. He's running for governor of Mississippi as a Democrat. Now, we're so pleased to have you join us, Brandon. Mississippi is Republican red, deep red. Haven't voted for a Democratic governor, senator, or president in this century. You got a daunting challenge, don't you?
Well, you know, I don't want to be least bit not looking at the challenges are there, but we got a heck of a lot of opportunities. Some things not only relate to the unpopularity of Tate Reeves, but also to many of the changes in the playbook in the state regarding how a governor is elected. So I think we've got a heck of a good chance to kind of catch lightning in a bottle here. And Mississippians are ticked off about the direction the state's going in. We've got both private and public polling that shows 58% of the folks in Mississippi, 58% to 30, 58 to 30 want somebody new in the governor's office. And I think I know I'm going to offer a vision and a and really a fighting spirit as a governor that gets things done. And in contrast to a governor that voters don't believe has any backbones, not stood up to get things done, and has made a mess of state government.
You know, I started to read Mississippi Today, which is a really new, terrific digital nonprofit. And corruption seems to be the dominant industry in the state, where politicians are taking welfare money intended for the poor and doling out to Republican supporters $5 million for a volleyball court. I mean, it's just awful.
Well, I mean, $5 million to a volleyball court and $1.2 million to Tate Reeves' personal trainer. You had money given for speeches to famous folks that never ended up showing their face to give the speeches. And so it's just been a mess. I mean, they took TANF dollars, temporary assistance for needy families, dollars that should have been targeted to struggling families who having trouble paying their power bill or getting things that they needed. These are folks that are working, doing the best they can, and maybe had a need that the state could have helped them meet as they're trying to dig themselves out of an economic hole. They took $77 million of money aimed at struggling families and paid for stuff, just like you said, Al, that were volleyball courts and personal trainers, and it just became a slush fund. And, you know, folks need to tune in and be sure to watch, because we're just now learning how bad and deep and possibly illegal all these shenanigans have been.
You know, Governor Reeves says, yeah, this stuff is bad, but it all is the fault of my predecessor, Phil Bryant. You know, wasn't me.
Yeah, well, he's got a PhD in blaming everybody else for other things. He was lieutenant governor during that time. And so whether it's this, whether it's the threat of 38 hospitals closing down in the state because we've been so crazy that we wouldn't accept federal funds for health care, he's like I said, he's got a PhD in blaming other people for problems. The way I look at it is, instead of running your mouth, run the state. You know, we've got things that need to be fixed. And you look at not only the welfare scandal, but things that are just – state government in and of itself here is bought and paid for in so many ways. And so, and nobody is more emblematic of that than Tate Reeves. I mean, he brags about the amount of money he's got in his campaign account. And, you know, so much of that has come, I believe, in fundraising in ways in which it's hurt the state, and what kind of promises had been given. And he's not a leader with a strong backbone, with a sense of guts, that's willing to go out and take on people in his own party or the other party, because I think he's just beholden to special interest, and his entire career has proved that.
James.
So I'm going to try to play the audio of your response to the State of the State. If it doesn't work, well, it doesn't work, but it's worth a try. So I'm going to try.
Good evening. I'm Brandon Presley. And as you might be able to tell, I'm speaking to you this evening inside a closed-down emergency room in a shut-down hospital. But before I tell you why I'm standing here tonight, I want to tell you a little bit about where I'm from and who I am. I grew up in North Mississippi in a small town called Nettleton. It's not a one-stoplight town. It's a no-stoplight town. It's a little dot on the map, and like many towns in Mississippi, it's the kind of place that Tate Reeves probably doesn't know exists and doesn't care about. When I was growing up in Nettleton, my mama worked at the local garment factory before it shut down. Then she became a preschool teacher at the local church just up the street. She raised me, my brother, and sister in the house that I still live in today. Back then, you could see straight through the floor down into the dirt. But with my mama's trust in God, we never felt as poor as we really were. My daddy was an alcoholic who never made it to recovery. And on my first day of the third grade, he was murdered in cold blood. My life, like many of yours, has had its share of tragedies. But with that faith in God that my mama taught me, I've been able to push through bad times, just like so many of you who are watching tonight. I've been there, and so I know how you feel as you struggle to pay the bills, get the groceries, and just hope that maybe you can make it to the next paycheck. But thanks to the values that I learned in that old house, I did push through. I went to college. I ended up being the mayor of Nettleton to fight for my neighbors and the folks who helped me become who I am today. We got Nettleton moving again. We cut taxes twice and balanced the budget. Since then, I've served on the Public Service Commission to fight for families and against special interests who too often rule the roost in state government. We opened up closed-door meetings where the public was shut out,
and we brought transparency to our state agency. I voted against boondoggles like the Kemper Power Plant and saved taxpayers over $6 billion. Many times, I had to stand alone. It takes guts and backbone to stand by yourself when lobbyists and the folks with big campaign checks oppose you. That's called leadership. We don't have it with Tate Reeves, and that's exactly why I'm running for governor. But tonight isn't about me and my story. It's about you and your story, your family's story, and your community's story. It's about the Mississippi that we want to build together. So I ask you, do we want to keep going down the same old path that got us here, or do we want to start winning again? Tonight, I listened to Governor Reeves' State of the State address. I watched his leadership over the years, and I know and see what you know and see. Mississippi is full of good people, but we're led by horrible politicians, and it's time for that to change. The reality is that under Tate Reeves' leadership, we're moving in the wrong direction. Nothing makes that clearer than where I'm standing tonight. I'm at what once was the Pioneer Community Hospital in Newton. It used to employ over 200 people. Now it's shut down for good. No doctors roaming these halls. No nurses tending to patients. No ambulances outside. No cars in the parking lot. Right now, there are 38 more rural hospitals just like the one I'm standing in, and they're on the brink of shutting their doors. If hospitals continue to close, the impact will be catastrophic. Jobs lost and health care for thousands gutted. Every time we close a rural hospital, folks have to drive farther and farther to see a doctor, and the true sad fact is that some will die. This is the reality that Tate Reeves has chosen to put us in. Make no mistake, he has made this choice. We have a solution. By extending Medicaid to the working people of our state, we can keep hospitals across Mississippi from experiencing the same fate as this one. All Tate Reeves has to do is lift his hand, take an ink pen, and sign on a line. Instead, he lacks the backbone, and he will sit on his hands while people lose their jobs, some lose their lives, and our hospitals close. When Tate Reeves finally wakes up and asks why hospitals in Mississippi are closing, he should look in the mirror. And this hospital is just one example of how Tate Reeves and his policies are hurting our families. Mississippi is at the bottom of the nation for economic growth. We're one of only three states that have lost population, and the numbers recently released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics show zero job growth in Mississippi. We're one of only seven states in this country that tax groceries. In the Mississippi Delta, there's only one pediatrician for every 4,000 kids. It's no surprise that we lead the nation in the deaths of children under the age of one. How is that pro-life? What does all that tell you? That Tate Reeves is only pro-life until you're born, and then he's done caring about you. While he brags about budget surpluses, family budgets are running out. And while you are careful with your own money, he's throwing your tax dollars away. He's been caught in the middle of the largest public corruption scandal in our state's history. $77 million of taxpayer money that should have gone to working families that are struggling, instead went to fund things like a volleyball court. A volleyball court. And paid for speeches by famous people that were never even given. Some was even given to Tate Reeves' own personal trainer. And you should tune in because we're only just now learning how bad and how deep and possibly illegal all of this activity was. But I'm done talking about Tate Reeves. I want to listen to you. I want to fight for you. Together, we can build a Mississippi that focuses on the future, not the past. We can build an economy that works for everybody. And it all starts in Jackson next year with a strong ethics package that roots out corruption and ensures that our politicians are serving us rather than being sold off to the highest bidder. It's time to send a signal to the special interest that the party is over and their day of complete control of our state has come to an end. It continues by funding rural hospitals and police officers, not stealing from them. Yes, we should fund the police, increase health care, and invest in education. Together, we're going to end this insane tax on groceries. We're going to make sure folks from Walnut on the Tennessee line to Waveland on the Gulf Coast can walk with pride because they have a job and they have hope for their children's future. Mississippi, I love you. If you need me, you know where to find me. It won't be under the chandeliers, tinkling glasses with the rich and powerful. It'll be with you. I'll be on your side. The holes in the floor have been fixed in that old house that I grew up in. But the values that my mama taught me and the love that made it a home are still there. Now, I don't care who you voted for or what political party you're in. I know that we're neighbors and we look out for each other. May God bless you and may God bless the great state of Mississippi.
So, Brandon, where can people send a check?
www.BrandonPresley.com. BrandonPresley.com. Presley spelled just like my cousin Elvis, Presley.
A couple more questions here. Give us the, when you were a governor and you make extend Medicaid, give us the impact that's going to have on Mississippians' lives.
Well, first thing is, number one, it's going to save lives. I mean, we know right now, James, I come from a little town of 2,000 people, as I say there, and I've been on the dirt and dusty roads of rural Mississippi the whole 16 years I've been on the Public Service Commission, and we know there are folks that cannot access health care. We got emergency rooms that have shut down, so we know it's going to save people's lives.
So, Brandon, I guess I got one more question. So Al and I famously have chicked up. We married better than ourselves, Judy and Mary. I think the same thing can be said about you. Tell us, I think your wife is kind of part of Mississippi political royalty, and she's just a terrific person. I think she's going to be a big, big asset in your campaign. So tell us a little bit about your wife. I think I'll.
Yeah, so it's my wife-to-be. We're getting married June the 3rd here in this tiny little town of Nettleton. She's Caitlin Mabus. She's a cousin to former Governor Ray Mabus, who was forced governor here from 87 to 91, and then went on to be ambassador to Saudi Arabia and Secretary of the Navy. She's a heck of a lot better politician than I am. And you helped make her birthday good, James, by letting us drop by to see you back in December.
Well, I will do, I want to do a fundraiser for you. And, you know, right out, you said to Waveland, you know, Bay St. Louis is adjacent to Waveland. So I'm after somebody who knows exactly where Waveland, but between the Presleys and the Mavises, I think we got some inside connections in Mississippi here. But anyway, back to you, Al.
You know, I just want to come back. I hate to do this because your wife is probably the most interesting story here, but I want to come back to some of the healthcare stuff. You talked about the hospitals, but the healthcare in Mississippi, you have the highest number of uninsured people in the country, the worst outcomes according to most of the data. And yet your governor says that if you did that, Medicaid expansion would be socialism like Obamacare.
Well, I mean, it's funny to me. They don't call highway funding socialism. They don't call if their pet projects get funded, they don't call those socialism. And he turned back millions of dollars on rental assistance and others. And I said last week, I think the only reason we turned that money back was it couldn't be stolen for stuff like volleyball courts and personal trainers. And so, you know, that stuff, the average Mississippian doesn't believe that hogwash. The fact is this, if I went to any rural community or any city in our state, and I said, I'll give you a dollar if you'll give me back $9. If I give you $1, you give me $9, we'd make that trade all day long. And essentially, that's what we're looking at on federal funding for extending Medicaid. You know, we put up a dollar, invest in our people's lives, health care, and create health care jobs to get $9 back from the federal government. It doesn't make any sense. Look, the former chancellor of the University of Mississippi came out just last week and said that Tate Reeves told him privately that he knew that expanding Medicaid was the right thing to do, but he couldn't do it for political reasons in his political career. And it just fits the entire narrative. When it comes down to doing the right thing for people in Mississippi, working folks, folks that got up this morning, got a sausage and biscuit and tried to make it to an upholstery plant in Tupelo, when it comes between himself and those folks, he's going to always choose himself. He's got a perfect attendance record on that position. And so it makes no sense when we look at, as I said, 38 hospitals that are on ventilators themselves. They're barely making it. And if you could have a secret vote in the legislature, Medicaid expansion would pass almost overwhelmingly. That's the bottom line of it. But folks don't have the political guts to stand up and say, this is what we're going to do and why we're going to do it. You know, y'all saw the vote in South Dakota. No liberal bastion in South Dakota that voted to expand Medicaid. It can be done in Mississippi, but we've got to have somebody leading the state's got guts, backbone, and willing to make the case to the public and lay the facts out there rather than hide behind these little political silly slogans that they use that's not doing anybody any good.
Well, as well as South Dakota, all those socialists in Idaho and Oklahoma voted strongly for Medicaid expansion.
Yeah. The thing about this crowd is they're out of message. They're out of gas, and hopefully in November, they're going to be out of office. These same old things they throw around, socialism or whatever is the label of the day, it's just to hide behind the fact that they can't get anything done. You got a governor that's in office today with a House and a Senate that are majority Republican House and Senate, and still hadn't been able to get any landmark-type legislation done in the state. And so it's as indicative against his leadership style as anything. I think I'd have a lot better chance of getting along with this legislature than he does.
Final question before turning back to James. What the black vote is about, what, 30, 35%?
Should be 38 and a half, but it's not.
Yeah, that's the population, yeah. But what's the vote?
Yeah, on a given election day in an average 34 to 35%, we feel confident we can edge that number up higher than that. And our polling numbers show, for instance, Al, that the intensity among African-American voters in the state against Tate Reeves is much higher than previous Republican governors. And so he's ticked off folks from Jackson State University to his being as much a part of the problem in the city of Jackson on the water crisis as anything he's done to try to solve it. So those numbers are there. Our job is to take advantage of the fact that for the first time in 133 years, and this is lost on every soul in the media, for the first time in 133 years in the state of Mississippi this year, we will conduct a governor's election under a set of rules that are different. So I was mentioning earlier, prior to this election cycle, if you're a candidate for governor, you had to get 50% plus one vote of the popular vote and carry 62 of the 122 House districts to meet the two requirements to be governor. Now, that provision was put in the Constitution in 1890 to disenfranchise black voters, and it was made clear with atrocious language in 1890 as to why the legislature did that. That has been changed. The voters changed that by 74, 75%, and now to be elected in Mississippi, you get a majority of the vote or there's a runoff. Mechanically and logistically, a Democrat candidate has not been able to focus on turnout in the ways that you should, because you had to not only get 50.1%, but you had to go to other districts and try to win them by 50 votes to meet both of those provisions. So we got a brand new playbook, and that changes things dramatically here.
Great. James?
So, probably, following up Al's question, the most famous political Mississippian right now might be Benny Thompson.
Yeah.
And what's Benny Thompson's stand on your campaign? Is he going to help? Is he all in? Give our viewers some sense of how you and Benny stand with each other.
Well, let me say, my relationship with Congressman Thompson goes back from the day I got elected to state office, prior to the day I got elected to state office. And we've enjoyed a good working relationship together. And he endorsed me an hour after I filed the papers to run. First candidate, first Democrat, he's endorsed for governor. And he did that an hour after I filed the papers. And he's not only been somebody that is that I've been friends with, but somebody who came out first day and put their foot on base and said, we got a chance to win and I'm going to be in this campaign. And I'm deeply grateful for that.
Yeah. You know, we were about a year ago, last March, I was in Jackson. You were there at the Friend Museums, honoring, you know, maybe one of the great Mississippians that ever lived, Governor William Winter. President Clinton was there and Benny was there. But I thought Haley Barbour did an admirable job of putting into context. And those two museums in Jackson, by the way, are really good. The Funny Museum of Mississippi History and the Civil Rights Museum, I concur, those are really good museums.
Oh, they're some of the pride of the state. And, you know, I tell people all the time, I've tried to help just privately contribute to getting school children down there to see them. I would put they're Smithsonian style museums, let me say that. They're to the level of not only exhibits, but learning that really shows the best of our state and the worst of our state. I mean, the time in which during civil rights and others, but it does it in those museums portray our history in an honest way in which Mississippians, I'm not saying you're proud of some of the content in there, but of the effort to educate where we've come from and where we're trying to go. And those museums are just excellent.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, when anybody's taking a vacation down south, you should really put the Jackson on your list, because they're magnificent, both of them.
And the Civil Rights Museum, particularly, if you want to see what things were like during Freedom Summer and others, and really experience that, Mississippi Civil Rights Museum is the place to go.
I'm gonna close with the final thought. You know, the difference between the chicken and the hog and a ham and egg breakfast is the chicken participates, the hog is committed. I'm your hog between now and election day. You got a hog.
I need all the hogs I can get. And we say it H-A-W-G, not H-O-G up here, so I'm with you.
All right.
I'll tell you one thing. One of my, you know, oldest friends in my business, and one of the best I've ever known, is Curtis Wilkie down at Ole Miss. And Curtis Wilkie says, you're the real deal. And if Curtis Wilkie says that, I know it's right, Brandon.
Hey, let me tell you this, Al. So Caitlin and I carried Curtis to dinner about 6-8 months ago, and they sat down, and it wasn't 30 minutes into the conversation that we figured out, heck, they were kin. He was married to her aunt's first. I can't get the relation right. And I said, typical Mississippi story. We go to dinner and sit down with Curtis and find out that he's Caitlin's cousin-in-law. So that Curtis is a great guy.
Brandon, he told me that, you know, he'd been teaching at Ole Miss. And he said, last year I taught a course that I flunked when I went there. I said, man. But I'll tell you, if you had Curtis Wilkie, you learned. Hey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you all for the opportunity.
One more time, how to get the money to you.
Yeah, the way to help us get this thing kicked off right, go to www.brandonpressley.com, BrandonPressley.com, and hit the donate button. We're glad to have you help.
All right. That's not spoken like an old campaign manager. Shut up for the goddamn money. All right. Thank you, man.
Thank y'all.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, James, now for the outrage of leaks. As promised last week, I'm going to call out the timid 20, those House Republican members from competitive districts who could be or should be the balance of power in the House, you know, if they had any guts. They all voted lockstep to oust Congresswoman Omar from her committee post. The excuse was she's anti-Israel. A few years ago, she made a seemingly anti-Semitic remark. Speaker Pelosi demanded she apologize, which she did. Republican members, before I mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, have never apologized or walked back their trafficking with anti-Semites or white racists or their threats to kill other members. So let's look at the members who think it's fine for Greene and Gosar to be on a committee, but not Omar. I also want to note the three Republican members, Ken Buck of Colorado, Nancy Mace of South Carolina, and Indiana's Victoria Spartz, who indicated they'd vote against this, but under pressure, they failed. They just folded like a cheap tent. The timid 20 who voted to unseat Omar while supporting the seating of bigots Gosar and Green are from Michigan, John James, Iowa, Zach Nunn, and the infamous Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Californians includes David Valvado, Mike Garcia, Young Kim, Michelle Steele, John Duarte. From New York, Brandon Williams, Nick LaLota, Anthony Desposito, Mike Lawler, and Mark Molinaro, Dave Schweiker, and Juan Siscomani from Arizona, Pennsylvania's Brian Fitzpatrick, Tom Keenan, New Jersey, Jen Kiggins of Virginia, Nebraska's Don Bacon, and Laurie Chavez de Remer of Oregon. If any of these are your representatives, why don't you let them know what you think of this hypocrisy?
Yeah, that's very good, and it's very good to name names. Don Bacon, been at 2nd District in Nebraska, which is very much of a swing district, he was considered to be, you know, the eternal search for the good principled Republican. He also announced that he would support not extending the debt limit. So much for that nonsense. And of course, every one of those will fall in the line until the political plane becomes so enormous that they're forced to do something else. The truth of the matter is, I can't tell you there are not some good Republican office holders out there, but it wouldn't take both hands to name them. It really wouldn't. And most of them, you know, like Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker, are not in office anymore. So they just, we can continue our search for the ethical, principled conservative Republican, but we're down to very few people, I promise you. My outrage is, there was a Utah State played a basketball game at Colorado State in Fort Collins. Okay, even I, who like follow sports, am probably not that into the Utah State-Colorado State game. And Utah State had a player, unfortunately, his name escapes me, who is Ukrainian. And a segment of the Colorado State students were yelling, Russia, Russia, Russia at him. And to Colorado State University's credit, they were swift with an apology and said that didn't fair value. The coach came out and everybody. But this is indicative of what modern America has become, where you have college students pulling for Russia. And you listen to this, and let me tell you, I listen to a lot of, I have the satellite Sirius, I guess you call it. I think it's like channel 124, the Patriot channel. You got to listen to just how bad it is. You're stunned that the sort of space out there on the far right is stunning in its hatefulness and its lying. But that's just what it produces, college kids yelling Russia at a Ukrainian basketball player.
Well, boy, that's just sickening. It really is.
And maybe some of them were trying to distract him from the free throw. But
yeah, but there's another way to do that.
You don't distract people like that. But you know,
the one thing about the Dukies down in Durham, they are usually creative when they distract people. They are not vicious and despicable the way those Colorado State students were. Okay. Hey, James, some of these great listener questions, I'm going to direct it personally to you. Debbie in Wilmington, Delaware said she's surprised to receive a text today from the DNC under your signature asking for a donation. She's a faithful listener, and she thought your advice has been to donate directly to candidates rather than to the DNC. Has you changed your mind? Where should Debbie send her money, James?
I don't know. They send so much out in my name. I'll see. But Debbie, I'm sorry to be confused. You can do it as you want, Bob. But I don't even remember authorizing the email. Maybe Valley didn't offer something, and I'm not angry about it. But I've sent out, I'm told I'm one of the better direct solicitors in the party. So, but Debbie, thanks for the question. I'll find out the origins of how my name got on that email.
And you still think Debbie should give most of her donations to candidates?
I would. Any prospective donor out there, particularly if you're going to be a $250 donor, I think the most efficient use of money is directly to the candidate in that account, because they just have more leeway of what they can do with it. I'm not saying you don't give money to the DNC or campaign committees or anything like that. I'm just saying for a small donor, I really favor directly to the candidate.
Okay.
That would be my advice, but I raise money for a lot of different things. But okay. I don't know. I just got out. I'll ask Allie.
Our next question is from Carolyn in Bella Vista. I think it's Bella Vista, Arkansas, though it could be Bella Vista, Arizona. It's AR. But anyway,
I think that's Arizona.
Carolyn is from Bella Vista. I guess she used ARK for Arkansas. That's anyway, AK, she says, that. How can we as citizens get an enforceable code of ethics for the Supreme Court? All other federal judges must meet published ethical standards, but the Supremes have exempted themselves with predictable results. Carolyn, you are right on, and I'll tell you who you ought to write to, because he's really trying to do something about it, Sheldon Whitehouse. It is outrageous that they don't have a code of ethics. I think there, I mean, I will say there was a story about Jane Roberts, you know, working for a law firm. I thought that was really a weak story, but certainly Ginni Thomas has I think violated anything that would be considered a good ethics bill, and they don't have to report some of this stuff, and they've got incredibly important, powerful posts, and we ought to know who they're talking to, how much money they're getting, and everything else. So right on, Carolyn.
Yeah, they're a separate branch of government. So if they can pay, and look, they're cynical enough, they pass it, they'll just say it's unconstitutional, it's undue influence. I didn't think the story about Roberts' wife was, I thought that was somewhat troubling. I mean, they don't have any. The stuff that you see, I would say compared to, you know, Alito telling people about the Hobby Lobby case and giving people access and give money, you know, it's maybe it's not in that league, but they don't care. They really don't.
James, wait a minute. She was she basically was helping people come out of government, you know, placing them with law firms. I mean, law firm has a case before the Supreme Court. Well, hell, every major law firm has a case before the Supreme Court. I mean,
If you're the wife of the Chief Justice, it's better not to be working. You know, if you be a law professor, but you get somebody placed in a big law firm and you make a lot of money over the placement, and that law firm has a case before the Supreme Court. I think that somebody would say, "Well, James, that you're carrying things a little to the extreme."
Yeah, you are.
But if you're the spouse of the Chief Justice, there's just certain things you can't do.
Well, I don't think that's one of them, and certainly it doesn't compare. It doesn't compare to Ginni Thomas. That's for sure.
Again, because nothing compares to that. But you got to be careful where you just compare things and it doesn't. You know, certain things you give up to be in a higher position of that in government. You just do.
I agree.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, look, in the scheme of things, it doesn't matter. Their reputation is such in the toilet now. It's just one more thing.
Yeah.
Hey, James, Caroline, in your town of New Orleans, says, what happened to Democrats in our state? What can I do as a progressive to help progressive causes? And how can we stop Landry from becoming governor?
Boy, I only think about that about 23 and a half hours a day. First of all, we're not, you know, we had the best governor, I think, of my lifetime in John Bell Edwards. Let's see how the field plays out. There's some chance, I'm told, it would be very difficult for a Democrat to win. We understand that. We have a much better chance in Mississippi than we do in Louisiana, and an even better chance to hold a governorship in Kentucky. Remember, those are the three big governor races that are up in 2023. The strongest Democrat would be Hiller Moore, the DA in East Baton Rouge Parish, but he's not decided whether he was going to run or not. And of course, he would have to, you know, he'd have to clear the Democratic field to get him in a runoff with Jeff Landry. But he would probably match up as well with Jeff Landry is a extremely ethically dubious guy with very extreme right-wing views. That I think
is the Attorney General, James?
Yes. I share our friend from New Orleans' concern, but it's something to think about, and it's actually something to worry about.
Yeah. George in St. Paul, Minnesota, says guns don't kill people, bullets do. Why don't gun safety advocates focus on bullets? You know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan really had an obsession with that and had all kinds of measures to, you know, make bullets harder to get. You're certainly right, George, but it ain't going to be any easier to crack down on bullets than it is assault weapons. It just is such a tough, it should be easy, but I like your idea. It ought to be part of any effort, but I'm dubious.
Yeah, Chris Rock has a hilarious routine on bullets, and it makes you laugh, and you should tax bullets and make people shoot straight. The truth of the matter is, I hate to say this, it sounds pessimistic. It sounds fatalistic. There's so many guns and bullets in this country. I don't know if there's anything anybody can do about it.
Yeah.
Let me repeat. Assault weapons were banned from 1994 to 2004. The country didn't fall apart. People hunted. People went to target practice. People joined gun clubs. And, of course, we made the mistake of repealing, or it sunsetted in 10 years because that was the only way to get the crime bill through. And, you know, you think of all of the horrors of the Bush administration, the jackass Iraq war, the financial meltdown we had in 2008. And right up there with them is letting the assault weapons ban expire. Right up there.
I agree. Peter in Melbourne, Australia, says, last week you talked about Trump possibly running for president as an independent if he failed to win the Republican nomination. Can you think of a rhino or independent who would be willing and able to take on Trump if he is the Republican nominee?
I might defer to you on that, but I do think that Trump, he doesn't care about the Republican Party. Yeah. Right, that's the last thing that crosses his mind. And if they don't nominate him and he thinks he can hurt him by running as independent, he'll do it.
He'll do it in a minute. Hey, look, I don't think they're going to nominate him. I think there's almost no chance or virtually no chance. If they should do it, I think there will be someone. I mean, this guy Evan McMullen ran against Mike Lee in Utah, ran a good race, maybe even Larry Hogan. But I think there are enough Republicans who say this is just, this is despicable. So I think he'd have there would be a candidate, but he's not going to be the nominee. Okay, James. Phil in Denver, Colorado says, do you feel that modern journalism is at a crisis? You bet it is, Phil. Local journalism is at a crisis. There are papers that are closing or downsizing all over the country. I don't worry about the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, but I worry about what's happening to communities. But I'll give you a good story, and I talked about it earlier. Mississippi Today, it's a model of what you can do. It's a nonprofit digital news site in Jackson, Mississippi, and they are doing one hell of a job covering that state and some of the really bad things that are going on in that state, and I suppose some of the good things. So there's hope when you see things like Mississippi Today, but the terrain is pretty bleak.
Well, I'll defer to Al about all things journalism, but to the extent that I know about it, I 100% concur with his assessment.
James, final question. John in Chicago, Illinois. This is good. Why don't the Democrats buy up TV advertising in the Super Bowl? They can brag about all the good things they've done and reach millions of viewers, and they can talk about the Republicans' attempts to go for a consumption tax and sunset Medicare and Social Security. I think that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah, it seems like, but they're very expensive. I'd like to see what the analysis is. I don't know how much of a political ad in the middle of the Super Bowl helps, but it's certainly something worth exploring next year. I would not dismiss that idea as being out of hand or ridiculous. But, there's a lot of research done on bang for the buck in the Super Bowl, and you'd have to judge that against, running, 50 ads somewhere else. I think it's a question that merits a further investigation.
Okay, keep those questions coming in. They are so good. We're sorry we didn't get to some. We'll get to them next week. So thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate if you check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper and Hold On Bags, in the show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them. When you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.